He is Justin Davis, user experience designer and ravenous reviewer.
And he is Aubrey Goodman, web services guru and commander of code, as well as becoming quite the kick-ass titanium developer as well.
Yeah, working on it.
Yeah, and this is a show that we call Distilled.
Welcome. We've got some new mics this week.
Yeah.
So since that redacted episode of Redacted with Mitch Neff
with
and his amazing sounding voice on that episode, I couldn't resist buying these nicer mics. So hopefully that sounds good for y'all. And
You
know, we didn't fuck it up.
Look at us leveling up.
We keep leveling up.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So, this is we took a week off last week for the holiday for Thanksgiving. So happy Thanksgiving, belated to all y'all. And, you know, thanks for coming back, because we'll be here whether or not you come to listen to us.
Yeah, we'll probably still be doing this, probably forever, actually.
We'll still be drunkenly bitching about
long after we're all probably working as clerks in Walgreens, but we'll still be doing this. This is amazing. I'm actually looking at something from TechCrunch right now that is the Bing Maps, their new 3D, hyper realistic 3D maps.
Hyper realistic.
Which is pretty crazy. I don't know. Does Google have maps that look like that?
That looks pretty nice. Are those?
It looks like a video game.
That's like a 45 degree elevation overhead.
Yeah, but I mean they have like.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wait, what? So it's like 3D.
It's actually pretty sick.
That's pretty amazing. This reminds me of Street View, which always just reminds me of Sphere because it's sort of the same thing.
Right. Yeah.
It's just that Google doesn't drive around with a 3D camera on top.
No.
They do, but it's not nearly as awesomely 3D as Sphere.
They should just partner with Sphere.
They should. I would love to hear that, because that would mean my equity would go up in value.
Yeah, that's
the Sphere app. TheSphere.com, or you can find it on the App Store at Sphere, spelled just like it sounds. Formerly Tourist, two words.
I thought really was a great. Great name.
Well, it's still great. It's just called Sphere now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, speaking of that, we had the holiday party last night for the Tampa Bay Wave.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of folks showed up for that at the Fox Club Cafe, which formerly Fox Club, now is Terra Sewer, I think. Or maybe they didn't rename it. I don't know. It's all
I think
still
it's Terra Sewer now. It's such a weird place, too, because it is probably the worst designed space that I've ever been in.
Yeah, like the bar is hard to get to. There's like a weird
It like compresses it. Somebody pointed out to me last night, and it's a very good point that wherever you are, you're in the way,
right? It's the
and
worst
it might
feng shui.
Be that it's that way so that you feel bad toward the wait staff and you tip them more.
Maybe
you're like, oh, I'm sorry, I was in your way all night, here's an extra couple dollars, you know, I don't know, but it's
here's an extra
really
couple of $20.
Yeah.
It's maybe a I need a pop really, filter.
I know, we need pop filters for these things. I have one of them at home.
Yeah.
But anyway, but it was a good party. A lot of people showed up at the beginning.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, a lot.
Yeah, it was.
And so that was great. I saw why I brought it up in the first place was I saw Joe DiCetto there, and I haven't seen him in almost a year. He now works as I think the director of web education at Full Sail University in Orlando.
That's correct.
And so he's also a former employee of what is now Sphere. And
really?
Yeah.
He worked at Sphere?
He was the CTO while I was
guest
senior developer. I don't know how
that
works.
I didn't know that at all.
Yeah. He's the one who oversaw the 2.0 effort, bringing the 1.0 that I built.
Wow.
And, you know, adding iPad support, upgrading the web service to be not a .NET horrible cataclysm.
That's crazy. I had no idea that he was involved. Huh. That's cool.
Yeah. Wow. So the way he describes it is his job was to keep me and Charles Armstrong from fighting with each other.
Killing each other. Right.
Yeah. I can't really say that went so well for him.
Probably not.
Or for me. Or for Charles. No, I'm kidding. We definitely had our headbutting, but I think we really pushed out a really great product in the end.
Yeah.
And in fact, some of the stuff that we had built into that that never really saw the light of day is finally starting to see the light of day with the spherical recording without a lens, which you can do now with an iPhone 5 or newer. So there's a lot of great things about being startup entrepreneur and tech entrepreneur especially, and sometimes you get a team full of alphas and everybody has to have their way and nobody wants to compromise, and so that can cause a little drama, and sometimes it makes the whole company implode. Fortunately for us, that's not how it went with Tourist. And
fortunately,
we're all at least still civil.
We'll leave it at that.
Yeah. But I'm really proud of that, of what they've done, and really, really, humbled to have been a part of it. And it's like we've been fighting a little bit with Up Valet because we have a lot of stuff going on, a lot of really important things to do, and not a lot of resources. And we're trying to get a product to our already paying customers. Like, they've already paid us, but we haven't given them a product yet. So I'm always on the side of publishing something and letting the users tell us what's wrong with it or what's right about it or whatever.
Right.
Maintaining that close relationship, especially with those, pilot, alpha, beta partners, whatever you want to call them. Last night, today we had this big demo, which apparently went quite well.
Yeah.
Yesterday we were, of course, agitated because Ty is my partner and CEO of FLA, and he's the one who's got to be there interfacing with the potential investors or, potential partners, clients, customers, whatever you want to call them. They're all sort of all of the above. And, so if he's not confident in what we have, which we didn't have until 10:30 p.m. yesterday for a demo at 9:30 this morning, I can understand why that's a stressful situation for him. But we were doing a lot of fighting over what does it mean to what does done mean? What is done enough? And, trying to come to that, to a compromise on what done enough is for a demo is sometimes a challenge. And so
it's very difficult.
What I told him yesterday was, come on, seriously, man. Are we building a product to demonstrate to investors, or are we building a product to serve the needs of, customers who are already fucking paying us?
Right.
And I get it that there's a need to have something for the demo for the investors or, prospective clients. But at the same time, they don't matter as much as the people who have already given us money.
Given you a check.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
So, and what I kept saying was, I don't give a shit about investors. Great. Good for them. They have money. Awesome. Right. When they give us some of it, then they will matter to me. Yeah. Until they do, I don't give a shit. I'm worried about the people who have already given us money.
It's tough.
Really hard.
It's really hard.
Especially with three alphas.
yeah, no doubt. And such limited resources. Mm-hmm. And you don't know whether or not you should build not enough and show it to people and get feedback, or if you should build too much and, build a full product or whatever. It's very difficult to understand where that sweet spot is as to what all you build, especially for that first, even pre 1.0 version, right? The thing that you use to sell the early, early contracts, get the early, early partnerships and all that.
Yeah.
That stuff it's very difficult. I imagine that it gets easier once the product starts to get its legs under it and starts to have an identity that you can then start to go sell it on its own merits. But when you're selling something that is still nebulous in its own, it's difficult to know what to make.
Yeah. And, it's hard to communicate about what those things are. And especially when you don't have, a seasoned staff of people who have worked together before, for a long time and have worked through all of the communication issues of, right now, honestly, it's sort of embarrassing to say it because it sounds pretty fucking Boy Scouts, but we had to start having a talking stone. So that we don't talk over each other, because if we don't have the talking stone, we're all three talking. I'm trying to listen, but I don't even get the sense most of the time that anybody's listening to me. Now that may or may not be true, but if we have a talking stone and I have to hand it to you before you can talk,
yeah,
then it makes you listen.
Hey, that
or it makes you be an asshole.
Right. As long as people don't start throwing the stone.
No, that was one of the things I actually said. Like, we need it. It can't be like a really heavy thing because we're going to probably throw it at each other. So, like, it's your turn to talk. Toss.
Yeah. You know?
So, if I have to toss you like a big heavy thing and it hits your laptop, you're going to be mad at me.
Yeah, exactly.
So, maybe we need like a heavy Nerf thing.
Yeah. Perfect. Nerf football.
Nerf football is the talking stone. That way we can bean each other with it. It's your turn now, fucker.
Perfect. So.
But yeah, I mean, it's been great. It's been great, and it's that really, really high energy thing that now I'm going to show my cards a little. My ex-wife and I, we were going to therapy for like the last maybe 6 months before we got divorced, and one of the common themes was always, you guys are clearly very passionate about each other. Like, you wouldn't fight so much if you didn't care so much.
Right.
And so I think that's a big
big
aspect of this is like, we really all really care a lot about what that product is going to be when it's like, when it's launched. I don't even want to use the word done because it's never done. There's no done.
No.
There's done enough. There's done for now. There's done for this version. There's what we decided was going to be our final product for 1.0, but we are all very clearly aware that there's going to be a 2.0 at some point, 1.1 and 1.2, et cetera. So, you know, as long as we're all on the same page about what that very first product needs to be.
Right.
And that's where it's been challenging, coming up with what that is.
Yes.
What that looks like.
Yes.
Because inevitably, of course, Ty, being the salesman, says it has to be polished. I want to sell an Apple product.
Of course.
And I'm like, okay, well, give me 5 other developers and then we can do that by the time you know, have asked for it. Like, I need an MVP by Thursday. This was last Thursday. So, and I'm like, I'll help you. I'll get as far as I can down that field.
Yeah.
But if I don't get to the end zone, you can't crucify me.
Right. Yeah. So. Man, only so many hours,
Yeah,
it's exactly. That's the thing about this stuff is oftentimes it's not that it's hard. It's just that it's a lot of work. It's just hours and hours of work of just going through the motions of doing it.
Yeah.
And it's hard to underestimate the amount of work involved.
Well, what I'm really proud of with FLA and something that I was trying really hard throughout this whole, you know, emotionally charged, heated, dramatic conversation, you know, where there's a lot of blame and finger pointing going around, you know, why isn't it done? Why, you said it would be done. And I'm like, well, you never defined what it was. So we're working on that now. And it's like, why are we doing that like the night before? I'm like, well, because we didn't do it fucking before now. That's why. The why is obvious, because we didn't do it before,
right.
You know, or we didn't have a clear picture or whatever it is. But it's not about that. Like, we need to just acknowledge, like, what do you need for tomorrow? Let's get through that.
Right.
You know, but just like what we've done from a month ago, and that was the thing in the end of it. It was like, okay, if you're not happy with the demo as it is now, let's talk about, like, show them a screenshot from a week ago, show them a screenshot from 3 days ago, and show them today's version, and that will impress them more than what is there now. If they're not impressed with what's there now, show them a screenshot of what we had a week ago.
Right.
So
progress.
Yeah.
Does impress
it, and I mean, I'm extremely proud of what we've done over the last 3 weeks. I went from a PowerPoint with nothing but a PowerPoint, just some visual flair, to an app on an iPad that connects to a web service that has like 10 different collections worth of data that it's showing, and they're navigable, and it's real data coming from a web service. I built the web service and the Titanium app, all of it, in basically under 200 hours.
Yeah.
So far.
It's really impressive.
So,
impressive.
It's a testament to what you can do with titanium.
Yeah.
And 20 years of experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Emphasis on that last piece there.
Yeah.
I mean, titanium does make it quick to build stuff, but, but it's still a lot of work. I mean, you look at the amount of code that you've written in the past couple of weeks, it's an astounding amount of code.
It is.
Just by lines.
Well, I mean, it's, you saw the AlloyJS,
right?
Almost 1,000 lines of JavaScript.
I wish there was a way.
And that's just the shared code.
Oh, God. I wish there was a way. I wanted to know this, and maybe Git allows you to do this, but I don't know. I wish I could count the lines of my code, like, in a folder.
Yeah, you can do that with grep.
Oh, Grapple did that?
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Now, as far as significant lines of code, there are Ruby gems that will tell you how many significant lines of Ruby code you have in your app by just interrogating static analysis of the code itself. But there's also, you know, just simple tools that tell you how many lines there are in a file.
Right.
Grep
right,
will
right.
do that on the command line.
Yeah, gotcha.
Grep dash C, lowercase c, as in Charlie, will do that.
Interesting. Can you do that for a whole directory, and it'll just recursively?
Well, that's just some command line foo. You have to, you have to cat all the files and then grep the resulting list.
Ah, gotcha.
Again, fucking MapReduce. It's always MapReduce.
Always
everything we
MapReduce.
Do, everything. And distilling that down to, to core, like to the real core value of that understanding as an information architect is incredibly useful.
Yeah.
We should talk about theme a little bit. We've talked about theme a lot over the past year. Just the idea of using a web service to manage the visual aesthetic of an app that's out in the wild,
right.
And being able to control that and curate that in time and remotely. So we would be able to say, I'm going to specify a Christmas theme and it's going to go live on December 12th.
Right.
So, you know, being able to do that, schedule that would be great. We don't currently have the ability to schedule it with UpValet, but we do have the ability to theme an app. You can upload, you know, default background splash screen remotely through a web portal that allows you to curate the theme on the web. And then the sync mechanism in the app will actually sync the theme on launch and every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Eventually, there'll be push notification based. And we'll dig into the theme a little bit, but I want to talk more about the sync dynamics, for some of the things that we've worked on more specifically over the last few weeks that have really kind of played into that and some interesting strategies, I think, that might be really useful for that. Before we get to that, though, the theming, what we're doing with UpValet is... theming means you can't say this panel needs to be red, this font needs to be orange,
right.
Black, whatever. You have to say this font needs to be the light theme, and it really changes how you think about styling your app, because you, instead of thinking, oh, this has to be white, this has to be black, that has to be, you know, hex value whatever for my color theme, you know, and then defining all those things individually, you need to really define categories of what they are, a foreground and background pair. So you say background color is white, foreground color is black. That means white background with black text on it. That's one theme, like one category within a theme.
Yep.
We refer to them as, we have several. We have default, light, dark, and those are what we have now. We're going to eventually start adding things like info, warning, primary, call to action, that sort of stuff.
Right.
So that you have the ability to theme individual things, but they are themed in category, not in color explicitly.
Sure.
So it really changes how you have to think about the user experience at the detail design level. I mean, the user experience, of course, is more of a time-space thing. What decisions do you have to make now? What available information is there? But when it comes to visual aesthetic, you know, being able to specify, well, that's, like, this modal is going to be presented over a dark background, so maybe it should be light background. So that means the light theme is applied to the, you know, wrapper container for the modal presentation.
Interesting.
So instead of defining the color values explicitly, you say this is light, or this is dark, or this is default, or this is, you know, call to action, primary, warning, whatever.
Huh.
So in so doing, it changes your how you think about designing the app in the detail design, how you're going to implement that design.
Right. So are you using TSS? For that?
No. We are not. We use TSS only for layout.
Right.
And then we apply the colors
by class
using those functions that we talked about in that walkthrough we just did, which no one in this podcast heard it because it was on a different recording.
Yeah.
So
look for that in the special sessions.
You'll hear the audio maybe, but you won't hear the video. You won't see the video. Yeah. So
pay attention closely now.
Yeah, and time index. No, you know, we will be eventually publishing the audio at least for that, I think.
Yeah.
Somewhere. Or at least snippets of it. I'm not sure. Still, though, you can apply the theme using other means instead of in the style, because especially if you're doing dynamic curated style, you can't do that in the like the TSS or CSS, because you would have to swap out that file,
right,
and provide a different one,
right.
But that one would even be like something you just download that. So we're downloading the values, and
Titanium does support.
It does support themes, but not in the way that you think.
Okay.
It supports themes more in the way of how you would internationalize your interface.
Right.
So it provides namespace theming within the file system.
True.
But you can't provide those files on the fly.
Right.
So they have to be built into the bundle.
Right. Yeah. Right. That makes sense. Because the interpreter is... Yeah.
Yeah. Because you're really just saying... I need to keep a set of theme values, foreground and background colors, in memory somewhere. And then whenever I show you a panel, I'm just going to, before I paint the panel onto screen,
ask
I'm going to, you know, go ahead and say this element with this specific ID needs to be, you know, default background and default text.
Yeah.
But this one needs to be light background, light text.
Yeah.
You know, these buttons need to be primary or whatever. However,
are you defining that? I mean... In Titanium, are you defining that in the XML? Are you giving it like a key, like a special attribute?
Yes. So the panacea of it for me would have been to define the TSS styles in Alloy.js based on the values in memory or based on the synced values for the theme. But if I can't do that, I'm not sure that I can't. I just don't know how yet.
Right.
So if I can, that's great. If I cannot, then I have to go through and explicitly define a function that, you know, in the global namespace.
Yeah.
If I do Alloy globals apply theme and pass in arguments of which, like an array of elements to apply the theme to.
Right.
And then a hash for what those, the background and foreground colors should be, or border colors, or, you know, anything specific to the theme.
I see.
Usually with theming, we do color only, but you could, if you wanted to make an advanced theme concept, you could make the theme have, you know, border colors that are not, you could, instead of saying the border is, you know, primary background or primary foreground, you could say just border color is a thing.
Right.
You know, you can define it however you like.
Yeah.
We have chosen to do it the way we have for simplicity, and because we only had fucking 3 weeks to build everything, including the theme and the web service and all the interactivity. And you see where I'm going with this. So I'm very, very, very pleased with what we've been able to do in such a very short time, with only three people, and really only just me doing the coding.
Yeah.
So,
it's impressive. Sure.
It is. Now, there's one aspect of all of this that gets messy, which is the timing on theme or on sync. So it would be great. Right now what we have is this sort of pull model where everything pulls from a web service. There's a since parameter that we use that says, give me everything since this date stamp. And that works great. Except when you have to do real-time chat. Because I can save those messages to the database really fast. They're really small. It's just whatever, you know, message you send with a sender and a recipient ID, and that's it. But if I want to have the recipient see that right away or as close to right away as possible, then I pretty much have to figure that out. And that if that means sending requests every 15 seconds to a web service, that's fine when I have one. But when I have 100,000 users all pinging every 15 seconds, we're burying our database with a whole lot of empty empty request queries.
Right.
What do you have now? Nothing. What do you have now? Nothing. There's a whole, like 100,000 people asking, what do you have now? Nothing. Like, that's a whole lot of work the database has to do for basically for nothing. So what I wanted to have is some way of registering for updates. So when the reps index, or like when the reps collection changes, somebody, you know, an up came in and somebody, you know, dealt with that, took some survey data, whatever, that's saved. Now there's more up data. So now I have to sync that.
Yeah.
It would be great if I could just push a stream out that is essentially like a, you know, the way that, you know, WebSockets work, where there's a, you connect to the socket and anytime there's data available, it sends you just like a journal.
Yeah.
What, here's some new stuff. And you just keep the connection open. And it pushes whenever there's data available. That's the perfect story, is if we can do that.
Yeah.
Between the client and the web service. Now, what we're really talking about is an OAuth authenticated persistent connection on an API endpoint, which sort of flies in the face of all the standards for APIs. Like, you want your API to never maintain a consistent, persistent connection. You want it to open, get what you need, and close as fast as you possibly can.
No, sure.
So, because so you then can you can
accept,
you
know, more requests.
Right. Right. You can scale. But we kind of want both.
So
because we can't wait 15 seconds. We can. And we can set all the devices to ping every 15 seconds.
Right.
But again, unless we have some really aggressive caching strategy that expires every 15 seconds,
yeah,
then that's going to be hard. And even if we do have a caching strategy that expires every 15 seconds, it's still a fairly complex thing. And I'd rather just, if I can have like near real time or you know, real time data, then I would prefer that over having to have some, you know, kludgy ask a whole lot of times, even like when data's never going to be.
Yeah, no, that's
different.
Right.
So we were going to do it with push messaging, but even push messaging is tricky because we have to do that on a periodic as well. We can't just say trigger everything, every action opens a connection to the thing and sends one push notification. No, we have to do that. Apple wants you to do that in a scalable way. So you have to say, like, store off all the notifications, and then run a 1 minute cron that pushes out all the notifications that are batched in the last minute.
Right.
Again, it's the same problem. How often does the cron happen? Does it happen every 10 seconds, every 20 seconds, once a minute, once every 5 minutes? How often does that happen? And so it's really just a balance.
It is.
And we're trying to find it.
It's very difficult.
But I was kind of hoping that we could find a way to do that with WebSockets, with like essentially a JSON stream of just journaled stuff.
Hard then. I mean, your only other... Yeah, I don't know. I actually have no idea. I was going to say, like we were talking about earlier, you could use Memcache or something like that to do, so you don't have to hit the database, right? But
right.
I mean, you still have to make the request.
Yeah, I mean, your router is still going to have to deal with it one way or the other. So I wonder how, you know, what would be essentially the best practice for that. I don't know that there is one. I think it's kind of one of those things where they all say, everybody says, well, sort of situational.
So right. And
for your situation.
And also kind of emergent, right? Because
there's
probably not a whole lot of applications that have this kind of behavior in them yet. I mean, there's probably some, but
it's
not wide enough to have a standard around it.
Yeah, and it's a tricky problem, you know. It's like the Twitter problem. How do you take everybody's... You have an M by N matrix of users, all of whom are following the things that are posted by other users.
Right.
And you could have a 1 to 1 million followership.
Oh.
I mean, Lady Gaga, last time I looked, had 9 million followers. It's probably way higher than that now, because that was almost a year ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, if Lady Gaga sends out a tweet... What is the systems architecture that makes sure that all the people who follow her get that tweet as soon as they ask for it?
I have no idea. And this is why they have 2,000 people working there.
Yeah, exactly.
Just working on that problem.
Yeah, just the multiplexed.
Very hard.
What do they call that? Multicasting is what that's called.
Multicast.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
Not an easy problem.
No,
as they say.
Not at all. Not at all. Wow.
But you know, that's why they pay some Twitter the big bucks,
or
the no bucks. I don't know.
I suppose. Yeah.
I've never paid Twitter anything.
I have not. I don't know who's paying Twitter things. Random investors.
And anybody who consumes that fire hose.
Yeah. Well, that's true. Yeah,
that is expensive.
And does the promoter tweets and all that. So, you know. But they still lose money, handily, by the way. So I want to talk about drones.
Yeah, okay. Let's do that. Side step. Let's do it.
Because, you know, over the Thanksgiving holiday, Amazon released this video about their Amazon Prime Air, which honestly was like an April Fool's joke.
It seems like it, didn't it?
It does seem like it. And, you know, somebody brought up a great point. It was a great PR stunt to get a lot of people thinking about Amazon over the Thanksgiving holiday when all the shopping's being done, right?
Exactly.
So
genius.
Really, really smart. But despite, you know, regardless of whether or not it actually is something that they're pursuing, it is interesting. And you know, we were talking about this last night at the party. It's like a couple weeks ago, no one, except for a few people, were talking about drones. Now everybody in the country is talking about drones, right?
Just like Bitcoin.
Yeah, just like Bitcoin. Bitcoin
two months ago, nobody gave a shit.
Exactly. So like
back when it was less than like $100, now it's like $1,200.
Now it's fuck yeah, me. Exactly. Oh, God,
I wish even, I should have.
I know.
But I didn't.
Should have. Yeah. FOMO.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because it does raise the what is probably obvious to some people who have been thinking about this for a while, but to a lot of people who haven't, it starts to raise the conversation of saying, are drones going to start really becoming a pretty integral part of how we do things in the future? I mean, and if you think about it, you know, the air drone is such an interesting example. There are obviously a myriad of problems with it that would prevent it from actually happening, but it's not
mostly political.
It's not unreasonable to assume that that in a few years some of those hurdles can be overcome, right? Some FAA regulation,
yeah,
some various things like that allow this kind of thing to happen. The technology probably still isn't quite there because the drones probably can't carry much payload, but they might. I don't know how much they can lift. You have to have bigger and bigger drones that can carry bigger and bigger things, and
generally 1 kilo is hard.
Yeah,
and
which is
a lot
of weight at all.
Way more than that. So
yeah, it's not a whole bunch of weight. So
given that the what is the airline cutoff for your checked bag? 75 pounds,
yeah,
like 30 kilos,
right?
So
yeah.
I mean, the average payload that we were working on when I was doing helicopter UAV drone design, they weren't called drones back then.
Yeah.
Back when I was doing that, you know, the payload was always like, yeah, it's as much as you can get, but if the takeoff weight is 25 kilos, there's a good chance we're not going to carry 30 kilos.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Because like the disc loading goes way up, and if you. Generally speaking, you need about half the mass just for the fuel. So,
yeah, that's one of the other big problems. Is a power issue, right?
Yeah, like, you're unless you have a high speed fixed wing forward flight mode,
right,
you're going to use an awful lot of fuel all the time.
Right.
Helicopters are incredibly power inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at very best, they're like 30-40% efficient.
Right.
Like figure of merit is ratio of actual thrust to theoretical momentum flow thrust, and momentum theory says that
you know, the bad thing about these mics is like
they'll get everything
loud.
Yeah. Oh. I don't know if you're off axis, like,
yeah,
they do have
that
cycloid whatever. If you know, if you need to carry something heavy, you have to have enough lifting surface for that.
Right.
And so you
have helicopters don't get to take advantage of, I'm going to use really wrong terms, but I think I know
okay
what I mean. Planes, like fixed wing aircraft, take advantage of inertia for lift, right? Like, because they're moving through the air.
For lack of a better explanation, yes.
And so they don't have to generate like an equal amount of power to generate an equal amount of lift.
Right.
Basically.
In that case, what you're doing is taking advantage of the fact that you're moving forward. It's easy to propel you forward. It's easier to propel you forward and allow the lifting surface just to passively lift you out of the air.
Right.
Versus throwing air downwards with abandon.
Yeah.
Because that's what you do in a helicopter.
Exactly.
I mean, you're still doing that in an aircraft as well. It's just you're relying on passive effects in an aircraft. And
as opposed to all
dynamic active effects with, like, if you lose power in a helicopter, you don't crash and die right away. Just like when you walk down the street and the wind blows and you see the leaves fall out of the tree, they don't accelerate into the ground. They sort of start to spin. That's called auto rotation. That natural effect is nature's way of, you know, essentially acting like a dynamic parachute. So even if you lose power, you know, as long as you notice it quickly enough, you can adjust the blades to give you, or to put you into what is called an auto rotation state, which is a constant descent, a constant velocity descent.
Ah.
So you're not accelerating, and you're also not decelerating.
Right. You're falling, and probably at a fairly good clip.
Yeah, generally. I mean, you've seen the seed pods fall off a maple tree. They fall. They don't fall slowly.
No.
But they also don't accelerate into the ground and split open, and then the seeds are useless.
Right.
So they're protecting the fall of the seed just simply by virtue of the fact that there's this big, imbalanced aileron sticking out the side, a big heavy mass at the other end, and it just naturally starts to rotate.
Which is a pretty brilliant design, by the way.
You imply a designer, but evolution has self-designed solid.
It has
thing.
A design.
Yeah,
And it is skirting around the. Right. Anyway, back to drones. We were talking about around here a little bit around the Tampa Bay Wave Venture Center.
Here at Tampa Bay First Wave Venture Center.
And, we were talking about things like delivering mail to rural areas using drones, right? Or all sorts of things.
Because that's way cheaper than paying the postal service.
Right, yeah, I know. But, could you imagine that if, a mail truck came up to your neighborhood and it stopped outside and had, 20drones on it, like a hive.
Yeah, and it just popped
and
open.
They all just, grabbed mail and went.
Flew away.
Out to, into the neighborhood.
That
came
awesome.
Back, grabbed more mail,
A little less friendly than my mail carrier, though.
Yeah, maybe. But
a little. Kind of a surly guy sometimes.
One of the things I wondered is if you could have a drone, because one of the things that obviously everybody brought up when this video came out, especially because I know a lot of people in Tennessee, and this is the kind of thing that Tennesseans would say, is, all right, we can get to shoot them out of the sky.
Right, and, target practice.
Yeah, exactly, which is absolutely going to happen there are drones, regularly around.
Not over my property.
I'm wondering, I'll bet you could make bullet-avoiding drones.
Funny story about that. When I worked for the military, we were doing this exact, we were having these exact conversations, and we said, what happened? We need to make sure that it's bullet-friendly. If it gets hit by a bullet, it would still mostly survive. But somebody made the astute observation that if a bullet passes through a lithium ion battery pack, then what happens is the lithium ion survives just fine.
Yeah,
it's totally fine. The only thing that would really happen is if the bullet severs any of the electrical connections, or if it punctures a fuel vessel so that it starts leaking. That's the problem. Now, there's out of these conversations came things like, what's the scuttle opportunity? It needs a kill switch. I need to be able to remote kill. And I don't mean just it's dead. I mean, I need to blow it up remotely.
Yeah.
And that's wherein the lithium is a beautiful thing. Because if you short the lithium battery within about 2 or 3 seconds, the whole battery pack will explode.
Oh, perfect.
Maybe not 2 or 3 seconds. It might be 5, but still, it's not 10 seconds. It's going to be you short that battery pack and you better not be close.
Yeah.
It will blow up, and it will blow up quickly. And when it does, it's a chemical explosion. There's no coming back from that.
Don't want to really be near that.
Yeah. It will heat up really fast, and it will explode. And you don't want to be close to it.
Yeah. But I would think that you could make a drone that is able... I mean, separate into two parts.
We don't want bullet-dodging drones.
Yeah. Bullet-dodging drones.
Yeah, that's not happening.
Well...
No, it's the speed, the responsiveness of a helicopter is so slow.
That's what I think
you
is
would
the
have
problem.
To know
you
that
could
you're
detect
in...
the bullet. You can detect the bullet.
I don't think you can detect
the
bullet either
because
it's supersonic. So you can't detect it you would only be able to detect it with radar, Doppler radar. And then you would just get a really strong Doppler because it's moving really fast towards you.
Right.
But that's it.
Yeah, I guess so.
So... Because acoustics, you can't, would you use ultrasound? Ultrasound isn't any faster than sound. It's just
infrared,
a higher frequency.
I don't know.
You have to use light. But in order to use light, you have to know where it is already. So,
sure.
Point a laser at it. Oh, no, there it is. Yeah, well, duh. You had to aim the laser, didn't you?
Okay, fair enough.
So, if you want an omnidirectional everything detector, then good luck. If you can make that, then I think you're rich already. By virtue of all of the things that you would be able to solve by having that fucking detector.
Yeah, so. It'd be amazing. Yeah, but I guess the motors also couldn't spin up fast enough to be able to get you out of the way.
Yeah, that's the other thing. No matter how fast your sampling rate is on your accelerometers, on your LIDAR, radar, whatever you have, those things can be 600 hertz, but it takes time for mass to overcome inertia. So if you have this helicopter that's spinning you know, 3,000 RPM in the blades and you're trying to change the collective pitch of those blades, it's going to take, you know, half a second, you know, a second before they move, and then like another half a second or 2 seconds or so before the like the air changes speed. I mean, there's a lot of factors involved here.
Yeah.
So to say that you would be able to like dodge bullets, I mean, yes, I'd love to believe that that's possible, but frankly, I just don't think it is.
Probably not. No. Yeah. So now, then you just have to armor the shit out of them.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. Well, or that or make them really dense. So you have like really high mass, high density areas, and the rest of it is really low.
Yeah.
So then basically do the Ender's Game thing where if you orient your body so that your feet are pointed at the guy trying to shoot you, he's going to A, hit you in the bottom of the foot instead of in the face. And there's a tiny, tiny little target.
Yeah.
That's just the bottoms of your feet.
Right.
Versus like your whole chest.
Yeah.
And your whole torso.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's like they say, always turn yourself sideways to your target, and then there's like a lot less surface area.
Yeah.
If you do the same in 3D, then there's even less space.
Yeah.
So you can do those things. It just, you know, it's a matter of design.
And
frankly, I don't know if it's worth it.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, what you want for aircraft for bullet survivability is multiple paths. So I would have just like, instead of one line for power, I'd run two. I'd run three.
Yeah.
So if one of them gets hit by a bullet, the chances that the other ones did also are very low.
Pretty low. Yeah.
Especially when you have these tiny, 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 ooh, tiny, tiny, tiny little, little moment arms and, you know, support structure.
That
sort of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
At that point, then I would be more upset. I'd be more curious and more concerned about the survivability of the actual physical structure over anything else. Because if you blow off one of the arms of a quad, it's not going to fly.
Yeah, see, that's the other problem.
I mean, it will fly, just not very well.
Yeah.
And only if you make some very, very different, difficult assumptions.
Yeah.
Such as, just stop doing yaw control. It'll just spin. Did you see that TED Talk where the guy does the like athletic robots? Oh, it's great. Anybody out there in Radioland want to check this out? There's a UAV, like a quad rotor, like athletic quads where they're doing things like balancing a wine glass on an aircraft that...
Oh, I think you told me about this.
It does all these turns and stuff, and there's like backflips and other things. So
yeah,
the idea of machines that are athletic is very interesting.
Yeah.
And especially when you can do that with a fucking helicopter, then you have my attention.
Pretty damn impressive. We were talking last night about... This is what Mama Bear... We actually think that Mama Bear could use drones.
Drones, yeah.
To follow the kids.
Now we're literally talking about helicopter parenting.
Yeah, that's exactly what we said. Helicopter parenting, exactly.
It takes that to a whole new level.
Literally helicopter parenting, literally. Exactly. And so you awesome. If you want to know where your kids are, you like put...
Just put a drone on them.
A drone on them. And the drone just stays at like, you know, 100 feet or 50 feet and just follows them everywhere.
Yeah, you text your son, hey, stop picking your nose. Stop it. I can see you.
Exactly.
Don't tell me you aren't because I'm fucking watching you.
Yeah. Or home sentry drones. So like...
It's patrolling the perimeter.
Just patrols the perimeter of your house the whole day, right? And if it notices anything strange, like with a camera, alerts the alarm company. I mean, if you could create that, you'd be bought up by an alarm company instantly.
Stat.
Instantly. Oh, God. Ooh. That'd be great. You go down the road and you see all these houses with these drones just doing circles around them.
Well, what would end up happening inevitably is like the drones are not coordinating, so one of them is going to crash into the other, and then you're going to have like... You know, problems where both houses say, oh, I had some serious alert. My quad crashed into something. And then the other one's like, I've got a serious alert. My quad crashed into something. It turns out they crashed into each other.
See, so it's got to have sophisticated avoidance.
Yeah. See, I had ideas for traffic management for, you know, personal drones and that sort of stuff, where you'd have a little launcher on top of your car and it would have a quad in it and it would follow you around. It would give you that, you know, extra intel that you need. So it's like Frogger. It flies above you. And then if you're trying to move across another lane, it tells you whether that's a good idea. You can have like a top-down display in the dash of like all the cars around you. It'd be great. Except that then you have every fucking car on the road has a drone following over above it. And how do you stop the drones from crashing into each other? Again, back to the same problem.
Right. Yeah.
So,
yeah, drones all will have to be completely aware of each
coordinate.
Other.
Yeah, they
which
have
they
to
could
be.
Create like a mesh network.
And at that point, then there's some really interesting data because then you have the drones following the cars.
Right.
You could use that for things like traffic monitoring, to put cameras on the drones and open that out so that then I can authenticate. Anyone can use my shit.
Right.
Then now we're back to real-time APIs. Funny how that works out. You talk about drones, you think it's going to go off to a completely sideways parallel tandem, and we're back to right where we started.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's how we'll do it on Distilled.
Yeah, I think it's cool. I wanted to get a get one to play around with.
Yeah.
Like an autonomous, like something autonomous. Oh, yeah. I don't want to control
it. You can get them for about $300. You can program,
really?
Yeah, you can program waypoints and... you know, do
for
all that
$300
through your mobile phone. Yep.
No,
we're doing
kidding.
This for some of our car dealerships. Since we're the technologists and we're the rocket scientists and, you know, awesome folk, we are the ones who are telling them how awesome, like, the world is that they don't even know about.
Right.
So we walk in there and, you know, we're just laughing about drones. They're like, what's a drone? What's that? What can we do with that?
Oh,
and we're
man.
Just like, all right, yeah, you know, what you want to have a drone that just, like, dangles a little fucking banner that says Castrio to Chevrolet?
Right.
You can see it from everywhere.
Yep.
Yeah. We can have it hover for 30 minutes and land.
No big deal.
And change the signage if you want. You can have them hovering around the perimeter. Just like, you can do anything. And they're like, oh my God, that's awesome. How much would that cost? We're like, well, the drones are $3,000. Because, I mean, we'll just take, well, you know, no, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
They, you know, they're excited because we can go in there and say, oh, well, for $1,000 for one day, we can come in and we can have a whole, you know, marketing day where we have your drone that flies around, you know, carries whatever you want it to carry. It'll fly, you know, whatever you want, whatever pattern, patrol perimeter you want it to follow. You want this one to go up above that one and, like, you know, do like whatever, what's not Foursquare, what's that game with the Connect
Leapfrog.
Four? You could do like Connect Four with like a plane of drones in the sky. You could do it if you want. I mean, like, the sky
crazy.
Is literally the limit here. So, oh, sorry about that.
Literally.
partially intended pun. So, you know, they get excited because we then walk in there and say, well, for $1,000, we can, you know, have a demo thing where we have three quads and, you know, you'll do it for a day and all this. And at the end of the day, we'll take the quads back.
Yep.
So we make, you know, we pay $1,000 for the quads. We buy three of them. We walk away with $1,000. And we keep the quads. So the next time we walk in there,
awesome.
We sell them for another $1,000 a day. And then the second time, we make $1,000 clean. So,
man.
And they'll eat it up. Because, I mean, some of these dealerships are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars a month.
Wow.
A month in marketing.
Wow.
I mean, when you think
that's
about it.
That's an amazing
It isn't an amazing amount. Because, like, one of our pilot stores does, like, $50 million a year in revenue.
$50 million a year?
50 million, yes.
Holy shit.
I mean, I know exactly how much they spend on their inventory, and that's just used car inventory.
Yeah, they spend...
Like, they don't buy the... Well, anyway.
Yeah.
I don't want to, you know, do any redaction later, so I'm trying not to say any names or any numbers and say, like, over this.
Yeah, right.
But, yeah, no, I mean, they are... If they're making millions of dollars a year... Tens of millions of dollars a year in revenues.
Yeah,
they can afford
certainly
$50,000 a month in marketing. They're already spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in marketing. So to walk in there and say it's going to cost $1,000, and you're going to be the only one in the entire city that has quad rotor helicopter drones flying around your car dealership.
Yeah,
they eat it up.
Oh man,
they love it.
No doubt.
So we're almost out of time here. I just want to real briefly mention one of the things that we're doing with UpLA is to offer technology, as we've been talking about, but solutions for that and just innovative things to you know, get people excited about whatever it is in the car sales and service industry.
Yeah.
But one of the things that we've been talking, especially with the Bitcoin stuff, you know, being really popular lately, is we've been trying to, you know, bring up the conversation of maybe dealerships offering the ability to buy a car with Bitcoin.
Yep.
And we were talking about this week, and then sure enough, what happened yesterday? I don't think it was TechCrunch. It was somebody, Reddit or something, published, sure enough, a Lamborghini dealership in California yesterday sold a Tesla for like 75 Bitcoin.
God.
A Tesla.
Incredible.
Not the model, not the sedan, the sport roadster. And, you know, maybe it was 85. It was a lot of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And especially given that yesterday's peak for Bitcoin was $1,200.
Except for the fact that about a year ago, you could have bought 85 Bitcoin for
$50.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like 50 cents
right.
at some point.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah. So, you know,
That's unbelievable.
Get on that Bitcoin, because at some point you're gonna be able to buy a car with Bitcoin, and it'll be through UpValet, hopefully.
Yeah, insane. Wow. All
right, folks.
Well,
thanks for listening. This has been a much subdued version.
Yeah, that's right. This was the working version.
Hopefully it sounded good, and you know, and it, as always, if you're interested in having us talk about something that we don't normally talk about, always just go ahead and put that up on Twitter with the hashtag #DistilledTopics.
That's it.
That'll do it for us.
All right, folks.
Thanks for listening.
Nice. End audio.
End audio.
Cut audio now. Advance slide.
I just really love these. I love how great we can get, like, NPR voice.
Oh, man.
And this week on Distilled. We get too much breath sound, though. It sounds like Garrison Keillor.
It is actually amazing to me, like, that NPR managed to find people who just... I mean, it must be... I mean, obviously they plan...